Hello, it's Friday, September the 3rd. This is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, we're talking about ABBA. Yes, they're back, and I, for one, am doing handstands and cartwheels. Also, football. England triumph 4-0 over Hungary, but all the headlines are about the appalling racist abuse from some of the Hungarian fans. A new report about abuse of children in schools highlights that much of it's going on in illegal schools. Question is, why do we have so many illegal schools? In Afghanistan, rebels have struck back against the Taliban in the one province the Taliban don't control out of the 34 in Afghanistan. But first, for the first time, a specific offence is being introduced for dog napping. So if you pinch someone's dog, you could be in prison for up to 7 years. So dog nappers are now going to face jail sentences of up to 7 years under a new offence of pet abduction. The Home Secretary, Priti Patel, said, "Stealing a pet is an awful crime which causes families great emotional distress." In March, Dog Lost, a charity that helps owners whose animals are taken, said it had recorded a 170% increase in the crime. I'm joined now by Wayne May, Senior Police Liaison Coordinator at Dog Lost. Wayne, you know all about it. It really is devastating for a family, whether there's children or older people who depend on a dog, when they go missing.
Absolutely. It's a huge impact on individuals and families when their pets and dogs are stolen, which sadly is on the increase each year.
Has the pandemic made it worse, Wayne, because people are stuck at home? They want company?
Yes, it has. Inadvertently, people were looking for companion animals to live at home with them, which drove the price of dogs and puppies up and other pets to an all-time high. And obviously, the criminal gangs and the thieves have capitalised on this.
Interesting that you say criminal gangs. So there are now gangs who target dogs, which, of course, some dogs are very expensive to buy.
Yeah, absolutely. Some of the cases we worked on in the last year and during the pandemic, it's more leaning towards organised crime, where there's groups of people stealing dogs rather than individuals or opportunist theft.
And what sort of dog would be the target of a gang like that, Wayne?
In all honesty, it's any dog. Anything that they think that's got a value. Prior to today, obviously, if you was caught stealing a dog, we was looking at a paltry £250 fine. It was treated as though someone was stealing a push bike, which wasn't fair. The laws were actually archaic and weren't fit for use. So it's quite lucrative for someone to go and steal your dog and sell it for £1,000. Even if they got caught, they're still on a £750 profit. And, you know, the new legislation that's brought in today is long overdue, but warmly welcomed as well.
And I'm just looking at actually now what the average price paid for a pup is. It's gone up from £810 in 2019 to £1,875 last year. That shows that they are rich pickings then for dog thieves.
Yeah, we've got, as a percentage, we're looking at across the whole of the UK, 80 to 90% rise in the price of dogs and puppies in general. But it's not unheard of where, for example, something like a Cocker Spaniel was being sold for around £1,000 pre-pandemic, and now they're being sold quite regularly between £3,000 and £5,000.
Lord, extraordinary. And is it right that only one in five stolen dogs are reunited with their owners? And even then, less than 1% of cases result in a prosecution?
Yes, it's definitely less than 1% on prosecutions. Obviously, the Sentencing Council, if the police and the CPS haven't got the tools to work with, which wasn't provided for them, with the law enforcement, then it was very, very difficult for police forces to act in some cases. But it depends. You know, we have really good weeks where, you know, dogs are stolen and most of them are recovered. Then we have another week where, you know, it takes a considerable amount of time. We have got a high success rate in returning stolen dogs. The only thing we can't offer the public is the amount of time it takes to get them back.
Yeah. Just finally on this, Wayne, we always think about the heartbreak for the families who lose the dog, but it must be traumatic for the dog too to be stolen and placed with a completely alien, strange family.
Yeah, it is. You know, the dogs suffer from stress. Some people have to take their dogs for retraining. Their moods change. Quite often, you know, the dogs are stolen, kept in little tiny kennels or crates or, you know, in garden sheds, so they're hidden out of view. So this does change the mannerism, you know, to dogs. But fortunately, dogs are quite resilient. And obviously, we are dealing with people that are loving dog and animal lovers. And they persevere with their dogs. And although it's still evident what happens, you know, the dogs do get over it and soon integrate back into the family again.
Well, welcome news. This might be a deterrent now to the dog gangs. Wayne, all right, that's Wayne May. He's Senior Police Liaison Coordinator at the charity Dog Lost. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and our video series. And remember, you can tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So Afghan resistance fighters clashed with the Taliban on Thursday. Both sides are claiming they inflicted heavy casualties. Meanwhile, the Taliban is expected to soon announce who will be in its government in Kabul. Joining me now is Tim Foxley. He's an expert on Afghanistan and a former analyst, military analyst for the Ministry of Defence. Tim, so the Taliban are going to form a government, of course, but it's quite clear there are parts of the country that are still not under Taliban rule.
That's correct. And if you'd asked me a year ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago, hypothetically, if the Taliban suddenly came into power, where would the resistance start? I mean, the first word I would have said was the Panjshir Valley or Panjshir province. It's an area about 100 kilometers north of Kabul. It's a mythical piece of land. It's where the Ahmad Shah Massoud fought the Soviets to a standstill, and it's where he fought the Taliban in the 90s as well. So part of the country, we have to be a little bit cautious. It's a small area, as far as I can see, that the Taliban control 33 out of the 34 provinces in Afghanistan. And because we have a particular problem now, the lack of journalists in the country, intense fighting, heavy casualties, I'm not quite sure about that. But there definitely seems to be something going on, some resistance.
And the rebel group, they're called the National Resistance Front, the NRF, I think, Tim, and they're under the leadership of Ahmad Massoud, who's the son of a former anti-Soviet Mujahideen commander. Is that right?
Yes. If you want, you know, a case of history repeating itself, this is almost perfect for it. Yes, he's the son of Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was killed by Al-Qaeda in a suicide bomb attack 2 days before 9/11. It was Al-Qaeda's effort to knock him out of the game. It was a civil war at the time, you know, the Northern Alliance against the Taliban. So yes, history repeating itself. I'm a little bit cautious about calling this a full-scale resistance at the moment. I mean, this has popped up very quickly. And I'm kind of expecting, well, we need to wait and see how the Taliban perform in the next 6 months, 12 months, even 24 months. If the Taliban are seen to fail, then these sort of things are going to escalate into more sort of organized, structured resistance. But certainly, this is the potential. The Panjshir is very difficult to invade and occupy and conquer. And the NRF, this National Resistance Front, know that. They know the terrain. This is the area that they come from.
Steep valley, isn't it? Which makes it more difficult, I suppose, for the Taliban to strike back.
Well, that's exactly right, and I think there are kind of sub valleys coming off, you know, so you can escape from the main valley and retreat into smaller valleys where you've got shelter. And the thing that I find particularly interesting at the moment, in terms of poacher turned gamekeeper, we've seen these reports of all the Taliban getting all this modern American kit, the Humvees, the MRAPs, you know, the artillery, the aircraft, and such like. I almost see this now as that the Taliban have had to become the government. They have to become the Americans. It's now them, you know, with the vehicles that are having to crawl gingerly up the mountain paths to inevitable doom, an IED strike or an ambush. So I'm looking with interest to see how the Taliban now change their mentality in terms of how they fight, if you like.
Yeah, it's interesting because also they've got the NRF on their hands in that one province which they've not conquered, but also they're fighting ISIS-K, who were responsible for the bomb at Kabul Airport last week, Tim, which we now know killed more than 170 people.
Yeah, I mean, ISK, Islamic State K, Khorasan province, they've had a presence for 4 or 5 years in the east, in Nangarhar, Lagman, Konar, Nuristan. I mean, that's not that far from Kabul. And yes, they've been fighting each other. I mean, the last few years, you've had this slightly weird situation where the Afghan government forces, the army, and the Taliban have both been fighting the same target, Islamic State. So you have that. You have the NRF just north of Kabul. Islamic State, I mean, we never have the best kind of feel of their capabilities, but they're still active with a presence in the east. And I mean, there are several different kind of ethnic and religious groups in Afghanistan who are looking on with alarm at the arrival of the Taliban. And some of these are known to have been arming themselves for the last few months. You know, beginning of the year, there have been reports of the Hazara community who are largely centered in Bamiyan province in the center, very fearful of the Taliban returning, and they're not going to take any chances. And they've been arming since January, February.
Seeing what you said about the weaponry as well, how this will affect the way the Taliban fight, because I've seen the tweet from the Northern Alliance, the rebels, so they're on social media. They obviously know modern warfare takes many forms, but they say the Taliban have modern weapons but dumb minds. Is that saying, Tim, that the Taliban have got this hardware from the United States left behind in the flight from Kabul, but they don't actually know how to use it properly?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And that's why I'm looking with interest to see what they do with it. It looks good. They've got these helicopters lined up and they've got these artillery pieces. At the moment, they don't know how to use it. And above all, they've got the mindset. They are guerrilla fighters. They're the ones that have been planting the IEDs, launching the complex attacks, the suicide bomb attacks, assassinating people. So they're going to have to completely change their headspace, you know, the way they approach things. And I'm fascinated to see how this, maybe they don't even realize that they're doing it, but I'm sure they are itching to get aircraft in the air and drop bombs on the Panjshir. And yeah, then they become the central government's armed forces. And as we know, it's difficult to get as we've just seen from the last 20 years, it's difficult to chase terrorists and insurgents around the countryside when they're hiding in caves or hiding in Pakistan.
Absolutely fascinating, Tim, and you paint a very interesting picture of what's going on there. That's Tim Foxley, who is an Afghanistan expert and military analyst. So don't forget to visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to our podcasts, our videos, our opinion pieces, some from me, and more. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at MailPlus or me at ToryBoyPierce. The Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse, known as ICSA, set up by the government in 2014, has been published this week, and frankly, it's shocking. It paints a picture of child abuse in many religious settings, churches, mosques, synagogues, or other faith organisations, and warns of widespread abuse in illegal schools. The report says that as many as 500,000 children attend out-of-school settings, around half of which are religious, and which exploit loopholes in the law. I'm joined now by Richie Thompson, who's Director of Public Affairs and Policy at Humanist UK. Richie, what do you make of this report, first of all? Pretty damn shocking, isn't it?
It really is. And when it comes to illegal schools specifically, it very much matches what we know from speaking to former pupils and others goes on in these settings. And for years, the government has been failing to take action to close the loopholes in the law, to shut them down. And I think this report really underlines quite how urgent it is that the government now does take action as soon as it possibly can.
Now, they're known as so-called unregistered schools or illegal schools. 500,000 children, we think, are in them, half of which are religious. How are people able, Richie, to operate a school in breach of the law, in full view of the law? How has this been allowed to go on?
It's completely bonkers, so please bear with me. But the law defines schools as doing certain things, like teaching English, maths and science. And so if a setting does those things and doesn't register as a school, then you know, Ofsted and the government can intervene and say you have to register. And if it does register, obviously then they can make sure it meets minimum standards around like child safeguarding, for example. But if the school doesn't do those things, if it doesn't teach English, maths and science, or it doesn't teach a broad curriculum, perhaps because it's just teaching religious texts and nothing else, then it doesn't meet the definition of a school. And so then it doesn't have to register, and it falls between the gaps in different regulators. There's no regulation of part-time settings, out-of-school settings. There's no regulation of home education. All pupils have to be either in education full-time or be being home educated. And what these full-time illegal schools typically do is they say, when Ofsted tries to see whether or not they are a school, no, we're actually only a part-time setting, and these pupils are primarily being home educated, and we just simply are part-time supplementary religious education. And at that point, Ofsted can't do anything else. And this loophole has been known about for years, not just by the authorities, but also by the providers, and that's what they're exploiting. And the government has taken quite a long time now considering how to go about closing that loophole.
And so some of these children, I mean, what age generally are the children at these illegal schools, unregistered schools? Are they primary school age, or are they older?
It varies from setting to setting. So amongst the Christian and Muslim schools, I think there's a broad variety. Amongst the Jewish schools, the Haredi Jewish schools, they slightly tend towards being secondary schools, because the beliefs within that community are that once a boy has had his bar mitzvah, he should just spend all of his time learning the Talmud and the Torah. So boys over the age of 13 particularly tend to be in illegal schools in that community.
I think this is really disturbing, actually. And the report shows that one child left school with the education level of a 9 or 10 year old. And apparently many of these schools, there's absolutely no respect to safeguarding, and there's homophobic, misogynist content taught to the children. And as we've discovered from this report, physical abuse of the children too.
Yes, and that's very much what we've heard when we've talked to former pupils, that physical abuse is widespread, that you know, we've talked to pupils who are third or fourth generation Londoners but have left school not being able to speak English, that we've heard stories of sexual abuse, and when someone does complain about it, then the teacher involved may just be moved from one school to another, and the fact that all of this has been going on for so long, I think, as you say, is just really disturbing and really needs to be brought to a stop.
Yeah, just finally, the report says, doesn't it? It says that while respect for diversity of beliefs is a hallmark of liberal democracy, freedom of religion and belief must never justify or excuse the ill treatment of a child or failure to take steps to protect them from harm. Impossible to disagree with that, but why doesn't the report go a lot further and say every one of these schools should be shut?
Well, I think it does effectively advocate that.
So the second effectively, it does. You're right.
The second recommendation is that the government should introduce legislation to close these loopholes. And if that
can
done,
take so long,
then that would. Yeah. Well, I mean, the government has already spent several years, you know, 4 years now, trying to decide how it wants to do this. And I think our message to the government is it's just taken long enough already. It just needs to bring about such change now, as soon as possible, before any more children have their failed to receive an education, or even worse, experience child abuse. And that cannot happen soon enough. And if the government was able to do it within the next 6 months before the new school year is out, then that would be really, really good.
Right, too. That's Richie Thompson, Director of Public Affairs and Policy at Humanist UK. Thanks for joining us. Time now for our regular sports update with Tim Nicholls, who's, of course, Deputy Sports Editor at the Daily Mail. Tim, absolutely shocking. The fact that England beat Hungary 4-0, completely overshadowed by the appalling racism yet again from that vile crowd.
I'm afraid so. I mean, it was a fantastic win, and what better way to shut them up than with a resounding win. But as you say, all the headlines this morning are about the disgusting abuse that the players received. And you know, you use the word shocking there, and of course it is shocking, but it's not a surprise, because these Hungarian fans, they showed us what they were like in the Euros, where they were punished. They were punished for discriminatory behaviour during the Euros. It was a very intimidating atmosphere, but there's lots of homophobic chanting. And UEFA, who are the European governing body for football, who run the Euros, have ordered Hungary to play three games behind closed doors. But of course, because it's football and because there's vested interest, FIFA, who run the World Cup, haven't implemented that ban. And so really, the fans shouldn't have even been there last night. But the fact is, Hungary, they will not serve that ban for 21 months until they play in another UEFA competition. So the FA are actually very, you know, angry at the moment with FIFA, with UEFA, for not collaborating on this, because the players should never have been put in that situation in the first place. But obviously they were. There was no collaboration between the two governing bodies. FIFA allowed fans in. You know, it was, from our man on the ground in the stadium last night, he said, you know, it was a hostile environment, but there was no sort of sign of trouble until England went 1-0 up and Raheem Sterling scored the goal. He revealed a message to about a friend of his, and that's when it started. The players were pelted with beer, with cups, with plenty of other things as well. I believe Gareth Southgate and the captain, Harry Kane, had ice cubes thrown at them. You know, these things don't sound necessarily too serious, but you know, these are footballers. They shouldn't be put in that situation and under threat like that. But obviously the racist chanting that thankfully we don't see in this country anymore, it's more faceless behind, you know, Twitter and Facebook and things like that, but you don't really see it in the ground. So it is really shocking if you're an English football fan to see that. You know, it obviously affects the players. They you know, they're not used to that. They've had it before in Bulgaria recently. There's obviously a problem in Eastern Europe, Andrew, with fans and their outlook on life. And, you know, the FA and Gareth Southgate and the players have always spoken very well on these kind of issues. And, you know, I think they'll be expecting a really strong response from FIFA. But if we look at their track record, I wouldn't hold your breath.
Just about to say, you're not holding your breath for that, are you? FIFA, was that the organisation which that old dodgy Sepp Blatter ran?
Indeed, yeah. FIFA are all powerful, really. They have the World Cup, yeah. Obviously, and they want to get, you know, they want to get their fingers in as many other pies as possible, because other than the World Cup, you know, the domestic leagues are so powerful. The Champions League, which is a UEFA competition, is such the biggest competition in club football. So they really rely on the World Cup being the preeminent, the biggest tournament in the world. And obviously the qualifiers, they're in charge of them. And I'm afraid we see this kind of thing far too often in Eastern Europe, and nothing is done. They'll receive a paltry fine, maybe a couple of games behind closed doors, but nothing will ever really change unless proper punishments are handed out. You know, if you ban...
They should sling them out.
Well,
they should sling them out. That's what they should do. Kick them out of the competition.
Exactly. And then, you know, there were an awful lot of fans in that stadium last night who did nothing wrong. Lots of families, lots of genuine football fans. And it's a real shame for people like them, because their entire night is ruined. They're tarred with the same brush. And not everybody's like that. But I'm afraid, like always, it's the loud minority causing problems for everyone else.
Absolutely. That's Tim Nicholls, who's Deputy Sports Editor at the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. Well, they're back, and it's the biggest event in music history, frankly, for me anyway, because I'm a fanatic about ABBA. The band is back. They've recorded a new single. There's going to be a worldwide tour, albeit they will be digital avatars. The band are now in their 70s, and Adrian Thrills has reviewed the two tracks that we released last night. Adrian, I'm so envious that you got to see them and hear them. How did they do?
Well, I think the new music, I mean, it's tremendously exciting, isn't it? You know, here we go again, indeed, the return of ABBA. I mean, it's just, it's hard to think of another pop comeback, you know, quite on this scale. The fact that there's new music as well, I think, for me, is the, I think the gigs, you know, these digital shows are going to be quite, they're going to be pretty memorable. But the fact we've got new music for the first time since 82, I mean, I know you're a huge fan and I have a fan. I wasn't that impressed with their career sort of tailed off a little bit in the early 80s. The last couple of singles, The Day Before You Came and Under Attack, you know, they weren't the best, weren't up there with the classics, your Dancing Queens and Winner Takes It All. But I think these two new songs, I think fans should be really pleased with them. I think it's a classic ABBA 1-2. You've got the big power ballad, I Still Have Faith in You, which Bjorn said at the event yesterday was essentially a song about them. But as with all the ABBA songs, it's a song about friendship and loyalty, but it has that universal appeal as well. And it's built around a lovely piece of Benny piano, and it just builds with the kind of pounding drums, guitars, bit of brass. It's a real kind of ABBA epic. The second song, Don't Shut Me Down, they're kind of a quirkier side, really. I love the girls' voices, and they're kind of, there's something about the fact those Swedish accents give them, I think Benny once said, it's, you know, for English ears, it's something slightly exotic, and I think they're singing brilliantly. And Don't Shut Me Down, it's a classic ABBA song. It's quite sad, you know, the lyrics, there's kind of a woman alone on a park bench in the rain at dusk, kind of contemplating trying to, you know, make a go of it with her lover, you know, a second chance. And it's this kind of sad, lonely lyric, but of course it's wrapped in this kind of big Euro disco romp that, you know, is kind of elements of German Schlager music almost. It reminds me a bit, Benny has a side project, which I saw a few years ago. He has almost like an umpire band, a big band. And this reminds me a little bit of some of the kind of stuff he did with them, you know, albeit with that classic ABBA Euro sound as well.
It's amazing still that the girls are 71 and 75 respectively, and yet their voices have stood the test of time. Because you really think they've still got it?
Well, I do. I think people, you know, when we kind of think of the big emotional singers, we tend to think of the American soul voices like Aretha Franklin and Otis Redding. But I think there's something really kind of quite unique about the way that Agnetha and Annifrid, the way their voices gel. They've got a kind of wonderful timbre and kind of real emotional punch. And amazingly, as you say, at well into their 70s, they can still hit those big climactic high notes that are kind of an ABBA trademark, that kind of really punch home the emotion of a song. And I'm really excited to hear what the album's going to be like. I think these first two tracks, you know, very different in style to each other, I think they really kind of whet the appetite, and you do wonder what they're going to come up with. I think they did these two songs. They first teased them, I think, two or three years ago in 2018. And I think they then find themselves, they had five songs, and they were enjoying themselves so much, they just felt they had to go ahead and make an album. And, let's hope it's a worthy addition to a canon. I mean, they give themselves a lot to live up to, because when you've written songs like Dancing Queen, The Winner Takes It All, Mamma Mia, I mean, you know, they are some of the greatest songs in the pop music canon. And, it's quite bold of them, really, to come back with new material. And I think it's obviously going to be a big nostalgic occasion when the shows take place. But, all credit to
them. And they're doing it in London in May. They'll be the hottest tickets in town.
Well, they will, yeah. And it'll be interesting. I mean, the fact that you're not actually seeing them in the flesh, you're seeing these digital avatars. But I think the crowd, the crowd is what's going to make it, because I think they won't need digitally enhanced vocals, because I think you'll have 3,000 people every night singing along to those hits.
Tend to be one of them.
And I hope to be there as well. I think
absolutely, Adrian. We'll fight each other for the tickets. Yeah. Adrian, great stuff. That's Adrian Thrills, who is the music reviewer for the Daily Mail on the return to recording of ABBA. Two songs. They're called I Still Have Faith in You, Don't Shut Me Down, and the album is called Voyage, which is exactly what they've been on for the last 40 years. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app. Every weekday at 5 p.m. you can listen to me all over again. I am Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'm going to be back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend and good night.